Hi, Jen. It's nice to talk to you again.
Hi, it's good to hear from you.
So let's talk about your story, A Cloud of Smoke. It appeared in the September 15th, 2008 issue of The New Yorker. Maybe you could just start by telling me how this story came about.
It came about actually because I saw a very small item in The New York Times, and out here in California, and so this had been big news in New York City, but I hadn't seen it. And all I saw was a little tiny note that said that this guy, James Hadroga, who had been a policeman, who helped, work in the rubble after the towers fell, shortly after 9/11, that he had supposedly died from inhaling the toxic dust at Ground Zero, but that the chief medical examiner of New York disagreed and said that he died from injecting ground-up prescription drugs. And that, actually, all that caught my eye was, how could those two things possibly be confused? It seemed like it would be a really clear-cut,
yeah,
whether someone had inhaled toxic dust or had been mainlining drugs. And so just somehow that was the start of it. I actually just got curious about what the truth was.
So this is just kind of a case of personal curiosity?
Well, I'm sure I was actually looking for story ideas. I doubt if I hadn't been looking for a story,
sure,
I probably wouldn't have made such an effort. I was wondering, and I think I was just thinking that, the world of medical examination is kind of interesting, and I was actually just kind of curious. Yeah, you're right. Personal curiosity, probably.
Yeah. I think we all have those little itches that we just feel need to scratch. So how did you get started? So after you saw the piece in the Times, what next?
Yeah, so then I think, my first step was actually to try to figure out whether, what had happened and whether there was anything interesting there. And so I couldn't immediately figure out what had happened. That was a little tougher, but I started... the things I wanted to rule out were doing a quick, online search. I found that all the tabloid coverage of the matter, and they all said that the chief medical examiner was a complete fraud. He was, on the take. Michael Bloomberg was paying him off to hush up the dust desk, and so that the city didn't have to pay out to all these policemen and firefighters.
Uh-huh.
That he was incompetent. So he was being just absolutely, slandered in the press. If that were actually the case, if he were incompetent, I would have been actually less interested in the story. That seems like an important story, but one that probably a daily newspaper is going to get on and do some investigative reporting on. So I wanted to see if that were the case. So I actually started out just by trying to find people who would know about the chief medical examiner's sort of work on this case and work in general. And so I contacted a bunch of folks, and I guess the main thing is that everyone I talked to a number of people who knew him, from the district attorney's office, from all kinds of places. Every single person said he is, one, the best pathologist alive. He is the kind of guy who, there were all these stories about how, there was something that, looked incontrovertibly like a suicide, and he would say, I think you'll find that it's murder. And then, like 5 years later, it would come out that it had actually been murder, or whatever it was. It was something that, he sort of had this extraordinary reputation, in terms of the science. And then he also, everyone said, was beyond political persuasion. There was no way he would be corrupt like that. So then, starting there, the story had become already more interesting, right? Because we basically have a situation where one hero or another is going to go down.
Right.
Medical examiner, who's, he's now in his, he was in his late 60s, I think, at the time. I can't quite remember that. It might have been early 70s. Either he was at the end of this illustrious, just meticulously honest career, and either he'd made a terrible mistake or something had happened, or else this hero policeman wasn't quite as heroic as he seemed.
So just to back up a second, so when you went, you wanted to check him out, did you already have some sources that you've been cultivating that you went to, or how did you vet him? Like, what kinds of people did you go to?
Yeah, actually, I had no sources. I did a couple things. I think I just started out kind of, the other trick was that he had had, he doesn't actually ever talk to the press. I think he'd been interviewed just once before for a Times Magazine article about the identification of the remains at Ground Zero. That was a very brief interview, part of a long article. But otherwise, he actually has a rule. He never speaks with the media of any kind, and no one else in his office speaks with the media. All they have is a spokesperson who will release a prepared statement, and that's it. So that was already kind of tough. But I was able to call and try to figure out. I actually don't even remember how I first started, but I might have looked in the past article and figured out who was slightly associated with him. I might have he's done just some sort of really rudimentary Google search on his name and seen other, you know, other things that mentioned his name in connection with people, even if he wasn't quoted. And then I contacted those people, so I got a really kind of motley assortment. And some of them were more useful than others, but invariably, like, that led me to who I should really talk to. And one of the people I did actually manage to contact who was immensely helpful. I wouldn't take him as the only source because he, you know, he works for the chief medical examiner, so he obviously thinks highly of him. He's not unbiased. But it was a guy who does work for him, and I had seen that he actually wrote mystery novels, and he occasionally wrote things for magazines, mostly food reviews.
Oh, interesting.
Jonathan Hayes. And so I contacted him by email and just said that, you know, I was really just trying to sort out what the truth of the story was. You know, we could talk off the record. That's really what I wanted to do at that point. So I contacted him, and he agreed to talk off the record, and then we had this long phone call. And at the time, he was very alarmed because, you know, this boss who he, like so many other people, worshipped, was just being just dragged through the mud, you know, in New York City. And so he really wanted to tell somebody, you know, he hated the idea that this guy's reputation was being trashed, so he really wanted to talk about that, which actually led to a later problem. He was extremely helpful, and it became clear that this was a really interesting story. And then when I actually had proposed the story to the New Yorker, I pitched it, and then I was trying to meet with him in New York City to see if he would help me, you know, a little more, help me get in contact with, you know, the medical examiner and stuff. And suddenly, of course, then it had been, you know, it was 3 months later or whatever it was, because it took a while for me to finish researching the story, and it took a while for the New Yorker to get back to me and everything else. And, you know, once it was a few months later, he suddenly didn't want to help out anymore because, you know, at the time the issue was very fresh and it was all over the news anyway. Now he didn't want to reopen the whole can of worms.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. And that is sometimes, you know, when you have something where people don't want to talk or they're hesitant, I mean, it could be a whistleblower case. In this case, it's, you know, controversy about someone's reputation. How do you get people to talk? I mean, in this case, was it helpful that this guy just sort of needed someone to talk to? Can you use that to your advantage?
You know, I'm sure it helped. I got to him in part because another, you know, person who knew and respected the chief medical examiner said, well, you know, really, the guy who's, you know, he's the right-hand man to the chief medical examiner. So I knew he was, you know, the guy of all the people there. And it was, I think it was partly my dumb luck that, you know, he happened to at least understand, be slightly more sympathetic to, you know, journalists in general, you know, since he, to some degree, was one. Yeah, but honestly, I think that one of the bigger, you know, advantages is just, you know, agreeing that it's going to be off the record for now. And honestly, if the chief medical examiner hadn't ultimately agreed to participate, that story would have died where it was. As it was really all about, you know, trying to get closer to this. And then I actually pitched the New Yorker before approaching the chief medical examiner. I approached the magazine with the idea that it would be conditional. They would approve the story, you know, if I managed to get, you know, the medical examiner on board, but I couldn't very well approach the chief medical examiner, who's never given an interview, without a publication behind me. And Jonathan Hayes ended up being a great help because he was the one who, I was thinking about approaching the chief medical examiner, making it clear that this would be sort of a profile of him. And he said, oh gosh, he would hate that. You know, he's obsessively humble, actually, where he really wants it to be all about the office, you know, the work they do. And he wants to sort of elide himself. So don't approach him with any, don't make a vanity appeal that this will be a profile about you. You know, say I want to talk, you know, look into the science of the chief medical examiner's office and the work they do, which was still true. And he also advised me to not email him, but to write him on New Yorker letterhead. New Yorker was a magazine he respected. And
interesting.
He was a portly old world guy.
Wonderful. So
yeah, it's a little devious, you know, not evil devious, but a little bit.
Yeah, well, it's a, you know, it can be a dance for sure. And that gets me to, I wanted to ask about the Zadroga family and how you approached them and what that was like. It must have been kind of tricky.
Well, you know, you'd think, and yet they were really easy. I think they were so used to telling their story to the media, and the idea was the media was always sympathetic. You know, they had this hero son. And so they just took it as a matter of course. Oh, of course I'd want to, you know, talk to them. So that was actually effortless. I just arranged to come down and visit them at their house the day. Though I will say that, you know, the tricky part is that once I was there, of course, one of the secrets is to stay a long time. because everyone has their kind of their story down.
Right.
If you just stay for an hour, you kind of get the story. But if you stay for 5 hours, you know, I have a friend who's a therapist, and her phrase is that people start to leak.
Right.
You know, like they can't, you know, like we're not sort of, you know, we're most of us not sort of FBI or CIA agents who are used to maintaining cover their stories or fictions or whatever. You know, stuff starts to come out. Like we'll either contradict ourselves or something will happen. And so, you know, there was actually one moment I really remember when, there were a couple moments. One was when he just was really admitting what a party boy his son was, and, you know, that he probably, he had done a bunch of drugs at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But the other piece was he brought out, you know, he has this whole shtick he would go into about his son's, his poor son and all the medical help they tried to get. And, of course, listening to this, you're kind of thinking, you know, his line was that all the doctors refused to treat him.
Uh-huh.
They refused to treat him. You know, as though this were some sort of basically conspiracy, they would refuse to treat him. And you're thinking, you know, if you know doctors, they won't order this extra procedure. I'm thinking, what doctor isn't willing to order? Like, they're all willing to order.
Right.
All they do is order extra procedures, right? You know, so that's the kind of thing that's a little suspicious on its face, and you keep pressing him on it. You know, like, what reason do they give? And he doesn't really have a good answer. He just says they were against him. There's another thing where his son's wife had also died at a surprisingly young age, you know, not long before. And when I asked about that, what she died of, he said, oh, you know, she died of stress. And I sort of said, oh, you know, I kind of let that go for a while, and I looped back to it later in the conversation and was like, well, so I know you said she died of stress, but, you know, obviously they must have a proper medical diagnosis for whatever she died of. You know, what was that? And then, you know, again, he kind of evaded it.
Uh-huh.
So it's just that kind of thing. It pricks up your ears. And then there was a final moment where he brought out a huge stack. This was part of the shtick. He brought out a huge stack that's like, you know, 2 feet tall, and he's like, these are all my son's, you know, medical records, these are all the doctors we tried to see, and whatever,
dumps
them on the table, you know, and there's all these folders, you know, full of medical stuff, and then I think to his horror, I actually reached out and took one,
mm-hmm.
and started looking through it, and he's uh-huh. immediately incredibly uncomfortable, and so I kind of, you know, just looked like I was innocently doing it, and then at that moment, I was like, oh gosh, yeah, I really needed a copy of, he'd shown me a letter that his son wrote, and I was like, oh, I'd love a copy of that. You know, can you make a copy of that? So he went to make a copy, and I just kind of, you know, browsed a little bit through these things, trying to look as harmless as possible while I was doing it.
Uh-huh.
And it was long enough that I could see that, you know, basically several of the doctors he'd seen had said that he, you know, basically had a drug addiction. He was addicted to opiates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it was enough to see that this was a consistent, it wasn't something that the doctors, it just came out of the blue with the idea of the opiates.
Uh-huh.
So that was that was another thing that was part of getting it.
Sure. Well, I mean, this really puts you in an uncomfortable position, right? I mean, you're basically trying to verify these facts, which you have to do as a reporter, and yet at the same time, it's almost like, you know, I don't want to say you're calling them liars, but you're questioning this narrative they've told themselves about their son.
Yeah. Well, and that actually is the real trick, right? And this gets into the ethics of it a bit, which is, you know, of course I needed to confront him a bit. You know, so at some point I did ask him very directly, you know, did your son do drugs? And, you know, do you not believe what the chief medical examiner? You have to sort of ask these things. You know, but the trick was, of course, I'm not actually obliged at that point to tell him, even though I'm getting quite suspicious, you know, I'm not obliged to tell him that, you know, this story doesn't seem to hang together, buddy.
Right.
So I kind of kept my own counsel, and then I actually went and talked to the chief medical examiner and learned that it was really, you know, that we had this kind of smoking gun thing. For what it's worth, everything the chief medical examiner told me about that case specifically was told completely off the record. So he told me, actually, that there had been this, you know, lung biopsy that showed no trace of, you know, particulates in the guy's lung after, you know, several years after 2001. So clearly it had happened, you know, whatever happened to his lungs happened, you know, well after 2001, after September 11th. And yet I couldn't actually use that in the piece because he just told me that so I would know.
Mm-hmm.
I would know what the truth was, but I couldn't actually use any of that material. So the initial draft of the piece, we actually had a ton more, sort of circumstantial evidence sort of making its case. And it was only, near the end when I actually got that, you know, got hold of the actual biopsy. The family's lawyer actually agreed to send it to me for reasons that remain unclear. I think he just wasn't really paying close attention to what it contained. I basically said, you know, well, we're hoping to get hold of this for fact-checking purposes, and he hadn't really thought about the fact that it would, you know, completely damn his client.
Right.
So, you know, he just said, well, I just need to get, you know, father's, you know, sort of approval on that. And I said, oh, okay. And then I, you know, I hurried over and called the dad, and this is the ethically tricky bit, right? You know, this is months after he and I have talked, and I still haven't told him that I think his son probably died from, you know, mainlining drugs instead of what his version is. And so then I have to call up and say, oh, hey, Joe, you know, the father, hey, Joe, you know, I just wanted to check in. We're in the fact-checking phase, and we're hoping to get a copy of that, you know, that biopsy you guys had done. You know, I talked to the lawyer. He said it's fine. He just needs to get your approval. You know, so, hey, do you mind giving him that? And so he says, you know, yeah, he inadvertently hangs himself. And, of course, you know, if this were, I mean, part of what's brutal about it is if he were probably deluding himself less, he would have, if he knew what that meant, he would never have signed off. You know, so it's painful. You know, he's a guy who doesn't want to believe this and has his own version of the truth, and so he thinks, well, you know, of course they're just going to believe it.
Right.
You know, but you know, so I'm not pretending to be his, you know, his friend, but I am also not revealing, you know, what I'm going to say.
Right.
You probably shouldn't trust me anymore. You know?
Right. Well, it's hard because so often sources, they, you know, if they feel comfortable with you, they start to think that you're their friend, or they trust you in a way. I mean, they want you to tell their story, but their story is very rarely the story that you're setting out to tell.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. And I think that's almost always a painful moment. Even the simplest profile is a painful moment. Mm-hmm. But in cases like this, it really reaches its extreme.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, though. I mean, there was this scene in your story where the family, after James's wife has died, and they've gone down to Florida for the funeral, and they're, if I'm remembering correctly, his father actually told you that, you know, the house was a mess. I mean, there were all these sort of signs around him that things were not good, and that, you know, his son was on drugs and all of that. I mean, it was almost like he could see it, but he just didn't want to.
Yeah, and I actually still wonder about it a bit, because I think he basically convinced himself after the fact. He kind of, which I think actually happens sometimes, you know, even people who, you know, say murder someone else or whatever else, they start lying, and then they just kind of shut out the other version of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was actually pretty aware of what was going on. You know, maybe not everything in his son's life. You know, maybe not the mainlining. You know, he knew he was a party boy. He knew he had drugs. And the dad had been very aggressive about wanting his son to be a hero. You know, the minute his son developed a cough after 9/11, the dad was saying, oh, you're a hero. You got to retire. You got to get the department to, you know, sign off on this. And he was the one who kept, you know, taking him to doctors and pushing it. So I think he got very invested in this scenario. And the real tragedy, which I don't even mention in the piece, actually, is that, because it's too circumstantial, but, or not, it's too speculative, I'm sorry, it's too speculative, but, you know, probably if the son hadn't gotten this, you know, early pension and gone down to live in Florida with no job to show up to and nothing else, he might not have actually, you know, just fallen into such addiction. You know, he was unregulated down there. You know, if he had to stay on the force, he might have actually kept his act together. So perverse and bad effort to get him the free pension and an easy life basically might have killed his son.
Interesting.
Which I don't know if he actually knows that at some level or if he doesn't know that at all.
I found myself kind of wondering, too, whether this pressure to be the hero, I mean, you can never know what drives someone to drug abuse, but I can just imagine that just not only the horrors of 9/11, but then being elevated on this pedestal and sort of having his regular life taken away from him, even though it was maybe in this way that should be good. I mean, maybe that, like you said, was the final straw.
Yeah, you know, I hinted that at the end, which I actually, it might be true and it might actually be a bit of a cop-out. I think I felt so bad about of killing the family's idea of their son that I kind of wanted to give them something. But I think the truth actually is much simpler, unfortunately. I think he was someone who used a fair amount of drugs anyway, and then he went into the hospital in 2006, I think it was. He hurt his back. And he went in, and they put a shunt in his arm, a plastic shunt, that the first medical examiner who did the original autopsy and deemed him a hero didn't even find. And a shunt is something that allows you to inject stuff without actually making a puncture, so it would explain why there were no puncture marks, no track marks on his arm. And he also came out and was on a lot of opioid painkillers, so he had prescriptions for those when he came out. And we, I know from other conversations with folks that, you know, that was what he was doing, was he was using fake names and stuff down in Florida and tons of family names and things to get more of these. He basically just got addicted to, sort of just the way, Rush Limbaugh did to OxyContin. Mm-hmm. And just got worse and worse. And I think, I don't know when he started shooting it up, but he certainly had, he had easy access with that, sort of the implant there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So did you hear from the family after the story came out?
Yeah, this is a really interesting piece. So the family, I did, both by my own ethics and by the rules of the New Yorker, have to contact them before the piece came out just to tell them, that we actually, what I found, so they wouldn't be completely blindsided by it. Mm-hmm. And we didn't actually do that until the very last minute because we still needed their help through fact-checking. So
right.
Until a few days before the piece ran, I was calling and saying, hey, Joe, can you do me a favor? But then I, when we were done with that, and before it did come out, I called them, and mercifully, they actually turned out to be on vacation, so I basically just got to leave a phone message. I kind of got off the hook. I didn't have to have the in-person conversation. And actually, I never heard back from them after that. I do always sort of stay in touch and said, if you at any point want to talk to me about this, because I think that the betrayal is pretty bad, that feeling of just being betrayed and then shut out.
Yes.
You're powerless, I think, is enraging. Mm-hmm. And so I think the least you can do, especially because you're the one who's really, got the public forum and has had to say, the least you can do is actually kind of, be there. Be there mm-hmm. if the person wants to yell at you or say something mm-hmm. different.
So what did that voicemail sound like? I can't imagine I can just imagine how nervous I would feel having to call and say that. What exactly did you say?
I think I probably tried to be straight and yet soft pedal it. So I think I said, I just wanted to let you know that, we finished the article, it's going to be coming out on Monday or whatever it was. And, in the end, I couldn't conclude that, James, your son, that James had died from, inhaling the toxic dust, at ground zero. It really, the evidence seemed to be that he died from injecting these drugs. But I think if you read to the end of the piece, you'll see that I, put in a bit about, why he might have started doing that, and that it's related to 9/11. So I sort of tried to soften the blow, I think, that way a little bit. The idea mm-hmm. that maybe it was the mental trauma that led him to become an addict. And to this day, I'm not sure if that's actually true. I kind of doubt it, honestly. But, it was a humane thing to do, and I certainly didn't have any hard evidence that it was otherwise. There was that evidence of the letter where he talked about how horrible 9/11 was, and who knows whether it was that or the back surgery mm-hmm. in the end that did him in.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Did you face any other feedback from people?
Yeah, thank you for asking that, because the thing I wanted to mention is that, I don't know what the family thought of the piece. I assume they did not love it, but I did never hear from them. The person I did hear from, who was furious and enraged and hated the article, was the chief medical examiner.
Interesting.
My hero. Yeah. Uh-huh. So he was the guy that I actually, the whole piece, I thought that he was an absolute hero. I had been amazed by everything people told me about him. I'd been amazed by spending time with him. I thought he was a lovely guy, deeply humane, incredibly sharp and good at his work. He basically felt like he had been duped. I had been very upfront about the fact that I was going to be asking him and everyone about this case, because I thought it was a very interesting example of how this stuff plays out. Mm-hmm. one of the classic complicated examples. But I think he really thought it was not going to be such a large part of the piece, that it was going to be mostly about the chief medical examiner's office and how it functions, sort of an all about the chief medical examiner's office.
Right, yeah.
And at some point, my intent probably was a little bit more like that at the start, but then the case became so interesting that it shifted, the ground shifted under me, and I didn't explicitly mm-hmm. inform him that, the piece was now going to, focus on that even more. And so he really felt like I had betrayed him because I'd done just what all the crass, tasteless media people always do, which is they focus on the one sensational case, and they, he actually had been extremely careful, even when his name had been dragged through the mud by this family, wrongfully, he could have actually at that point legitimately come out and said, actually we have counter evidence and presented it, mm-hmm. And he opted to, maintain his silence and just respect that it was an angry family. And one difference to me is that if this had just been just a family matter, mm-hmm. in a family that didn't want to believe that their son had died from using drugs, you know, that's fine. You know, who am I to help, you know, disabuse them of that? But when it comes down to sort of millions in appropriations are being, you know, like there's congressional bills being named after James Adroga, mm-hmm. You know, with the idea that we need to be, you know, helping people for time. Like he was the first and very influential supposed death from the dust, inhaling dust at Ground Zero. Mm-hmm. And he was like the launching point for all these, you know, all these expenditures. And mm-hmm. so at that point, I think, you know, it's, and clearly the family was, you know, they also weren't really keeping their silence about this. The father was traveling around to events in this huge truck emblazoned with his son's name and, you know, lobbying for all this and, you know, and doing fairly well for himself out of it. And I think it, at that point, it felt like it was a legitimate, it was sort of, open season, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of feel like this is almost a template for so many medical stories where you have, you know, this heartbreaking anecdote from someone in a family, you know, survivors who are really upset. They want to do something, but oftentimes, you know, it's just not based on the science or the things that they want to do are sort of wrongheaded. And it really puts those people who, you know, want to sort of correct things to the facts in a really awkward position.
No, it's really true. I think for me, though, one of the big things was just it's such a lesson in the fact that you really can't know. You know, like students that I teach are always, you know, you kind of worry about how you're going to be perceived by the person you're writing about. You know, are they going to like the piece? Are they going to continue to like you? You know, and it's at the end of the day, you know, I've done pieces that I thought, God, this person is, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they, you know, like put out a contract on my life or something. I'm going to be disappointed in what I concluded. You know, and in one of the cases was, you know, the wife of a famous scientist who went to jail for molesting the daughter of a colleague. And
oh, right.
She really hoped that I would find out that he hadn't done it because that's what she believed, and she thought the evidence could point to that. And I told her I'd look into it, but, you know, I would have to conclude what I concluded. And I concluded that there was absolutely no doubt he had molested this girl.
Mm-hmm.
And she, for several years, sent me Christmas cards afterwards. You know,
wow.
And would occasionally say that she, you know, if I was in town, she'd love to visit. And I think it was just having someone who knew the whole story and still, you know, sort of, I mean, who knew the truth and she didn't have to deny anything. I don't know. She's still in denial about it, honestly, but I don't quite know. I actually don't quite know why she, you know, why she wanted to stay in touch. But it might have been something of a relief. I know that the article did at least lead some other former friends to kind of get in touch with her again and say how sorry they felt for her experience. So I'll say that for all that, you know, there'll be someone like the chief medical examiner who you think, oh, my God, how can this guy, you know, he must love this piece. I'm making him be a hero. It's like I'm his personal PR agent. And then he just, you know, he despises you and never speaks to you again. So
you can never predict. You can never predict. And it's never the things you think that will upset them that do it. It's always something else.
Yeah, exactly right. Apparently, someone was just telling me that one of the things that makes people most enraged is being called bald. It was like a lot of litigation. you think that would be a pretty, you know, factually easy one, but apparently bald is really to be avoided at all costs.
That's right, it's balding, right?
Maybe, I don't know. Balding is maybe the problem, but whatever it is, that's apparently an extremely sensitive subject. So.
Right. Well, that's kind of a good segue into, so I should invite you to come. I'll be giving an Ignite talk on Friday night at the NESW.